Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is SOD1 of For the Record program number 660, titled Walking the Snake in the Middle East, Part 1, The von Bolschwing Legacy. This program is being recorded on January 18th of the year 2009. This program will be exemplary of why listeners should take advantage of the huge amount of information available on the Spitfire website and linked websites. That website, SpitfireList.com, a cornucopia of anti-fascist information linked to many other websites which, taken in combination, provide the best source available for this type of information. As of the beginning of 2009, all of the old archive shows are available for download for free on MP3. This is a huge, huge step forward and a big tip of the hat to the heroic webmaster who, in considerable measure, made this possible. This program is going to be, as is often the case on For the Record, a look back and a look ahead. There are going to be two programs titled Walking the Snake in the Middle East. This one, 660, and next week's program, 661. The reference in the title is to the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that I've referenced so often on this program. The book Serpent's Walk and the book The Turner Diaries in many ways are blueprints for what has been unfolding and what is going to unfold. Both of those are ostensibly novels, but as I've said so many times, they are in fact manifestos. They're blueprints for what a Third Reich gone underground is actually planning to do. In this particular series, we're going to be talking about the book Serpent's Walk. The book Serpent's Walk, again, a quote, novel, unquote, actually a blueprint for what is taking place. In that book, the Third Reich and the SS go underground at the end of World War II. That happened. They build up their economic strength. That happened. Then they buy into the opinion-forming media, and they infiltrate the military and other aspects of American society. When society is devastated by a series of terror incidents using weapons of mass destruction that are brought in through the drug smuggling routes, think Hopsicker here, then martial law is declared and the underground Reich takes over the United States. In this particular novel, obviously the Third Reich is presented as the good guys, and the bad guys are, of course, to choose. Yeah? And in the book, it concludes with an underground Reich preemptive strike on Israel, supposedly because the Israelis were planning on striking first. As I've said before, I think that both of these books, both the Turner Diaries and the book Serpent's Walk, the former authored by one Andrew MacDonald, actually William Luther Pierce, head of the National Alliance, and the other by one Randolph D. Calverhall, whose real name I don't know, but both of these books are not to be seen as mere fluff or light reading. In fact, they are, in the most literal sense of the word, deadly serious. For example, the author of the Turner Diaries, William Luther Pierce, in the 1990s did a shortwave radio broadcast called Bin Laden is called Stay Out of Tall Buildings. And in it, he warned people who live in New York, who live or work in buildings about the size of the World Trade Center, that they should start wearing hard hats, that Osama bin Laden was coming, and that the U.S. would be hit by weapons, biological terror weapons. Well, of course, all of those things did in fact happen. The Turner Diaries, by the way, concludes, the climactic episode of the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon, and that enables the Nazi underground to take over. The organization in the Order is called the Order. In the book Serpent's Walk, rather, in the book The Turner Diaries is called the Order. That was the name that a group of Nazi cadre slash terrorists applied to themselves in the 1980s. Perhaps their most publicized act was the murder of Alan Berg, a Denver talk show host. They were funded by, quote, Nazi families, unquote, in Latin America, according to a member of that group. We know who that is, don't we? And I would note that the Turner Diaries, the climactic episode, the low-level suicide aerial attack against the Pentagon, takes place on November 9th of 1993. November 9th was a very important date to the Nazis. It was the date in 1918 when German sailors of the High Seas Fleet raised the red flag, basically, and revolted against the Kaiser's government. It was that revolt that signaled the end of the First World War and the German armistice. It was for that reason that Hitler picked November 9th of 1923 as the date for his beer hall putsch. Likewise, the date November 9th, 1938 was selected as the date for Die Kristallnacht, the first organized countrywide anti-Semitic pogrom of the Third Reich. The Berlin Wall, not incidentally, came down on November 9th of 1989. German reunification overseen by Gunter Strassmayr, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, whose son Andreas Strassmayr was not only the mentor to Timothy McVeigh, according to unimpeached testimony by an ATF informant named Carol Howe, but he was also the planner of the Oklahoma City bombing. Well, how would a German or any other European write the date November 9th? 9/11. And of course, now we should remember when I talk about the book Turner Diaries being a blueprint. I'm just a crazy conspiracy theorist from California, and that's just a novel. We know nothing like that, a low-level suicide aerial attack against the Pentagon. That couldn't happen in real life, could it? Nah, particularly not on a date named September, on the date September 11th. We should not, before we leave the subject of William Luther Pierce, lose sight of the fact that Pierce himself and his National Alliance were closely associated with the German NPD. That is arguably the most important of the German neo-Nazi parties. Also close to the German NPD is Ahmed Huber of the Bank Al-Taqwa, about whom we'll say more in just a minute. Now, Ahmed Huber, the aforementioned Ahmed Huber, is a very interesting fellow because with Huber, we see a fellow who bridges the world of Islamic fascism. He's a director of the Bank Al-Taqwa and a converted Muslim. He also is very close to the German, quote, neo-unquote Nazi parties. I don't like the term neo, but it's passed into popular usage. And also, Ahmed Huber, that is, through the Bank Al-Taqwa, has links running to the GOP and the Republican Party. We're going to quote from an article that ran in the San Francisco Chronicle of March 12th of 2002. It's by Jay Bushinsky. It's titled, Swiss Probe Anti-U.S. Neo-Nazi. And there's a quote in there from Ahmed Huber. It talks about the inevitability of a change in U.S. public opinion. And Huber was quoted in this article. The U.S. is the ally of 15 million Jews against 1.3 billion Muslims. It is allied with 5 million Israelis against 200 million Arabs. We will bring down the Israel lobby and change foreign policy. We'll do it in America. When it happens, you'll understand. Unquote. I would suggest, before I do a little bit of brief editing of some of the numbers here, as presented by Huber. It's basically accurate, but it's actually slightly exaggerated. I would submit that this is precisely what we are seeing in the world and in particular in the United States today. And in the two broadcasts, for the record, 660 and 661, we're going to take a look at some of the factors involved here, some of the political and economic and historical factors involved here. The exact world Jewish population, by the way, is to a certain extent debatable. 15 million wouldn't be a bad guess. 12 million also wouldn't be a bad guess. It's somewhere between 2/3 and 75% of the population of Mexico City. And according to the last demographics I saw, they're closer to 300 million Arabs at this point. But then again, perhaps his figures as quoted here were relatively old. But in any event, I would submit that Serpent's Walk is in fact taking place right now. We do know that as a matter of fact, the SS and the Third Reich went underground at the end of World War II. We're going to review a little bit about that during the course of the broadcast. They did indeed build up their economic muscle. They have indeed bought into the opinion-forming media, and they are changing the opinion-forming media. I have done a lot of work on the book Serpent's Walk, so go to spitfirelist.com and just use the search engine for Serpent's Walk. There's a ton of information in there, including quotes from the text. Bear in mind that what ultimately takes place in Serpent's Walk is a Nazi takeover of the America of the United States and the world, and that this follows the U.S. being devastated by terrorist attacks using genetically engineered biological weapons. Martial law is declared. The Nazis infiltrate the military, take over the country, and ultimately launch a preemptive strike against the treacherous Israelis, which is widely well received by world opinion, which has been changed through the use of the Nazi control of the opinion-forming media. I've spoken at considerable length in past broadcasts about German corporate control of the media. The largest English-language publishing house, Random House, is now owned by Bertelsmann, which was the publisher for the SS in World War II, whose progenitor, Heinrich Mohn, was in the SS, and whose house historian Dirk Bavendam, as recently as 1998, published a book that blamed World War II on the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, U.S. imperialism, and Jewish control of, you guessed it, the news media as well as the U.S. government. An interesting perspective. The von Holtzbrinck House also is controlled, another large English language publisher, by a German publisher with Third Reich's, the von Holtzbrinck Company, I should say, another German publisher with roots in the Third Reich, controls much of the rest of English language publishing. The largest media corporation in the world, if one expands out the underground Reich to include its Muslim Brotherhood allies, the Saudis in particular, largest media corporation in the world, AOL, Time Warner, controlled by Prince Al Walid of Saudi Arabia in combination with a minority consortium of Saudi princes. Al Walid is Muslim Brotherhood, hosts telethons in Saudi Arabia, raising money for Hamas, the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. That very same Prince Al Walid is the number two stockholder in News Corp, parent company of Fox News, recently increased his stock and changed it to voting stock. Prince Al Walid is one of the dominant investors in the Disney Resorts division. ABC Disney is the third largest media corporation in the world, and Disney derives a lot of its income and is heavily invested in its resorts division. The other half, ABC, the ABC part of Disney, derives from Cap Cities, which was founded by William Casey. William Casey was the State Department operative who helped to bring the Nazi war criminals into the U.S. at the end of World War II under the Crusade for Freedom. And Casey had as his personal pilot Heinrich Rupp, a Luftwaffe ME-262 pilot. Then the fourth largest corporation, Bertelsmann, publisher for the SS, and so forth. What we are looking at in the world today, again, in my considered professional opinion, is a very significant part of the realization of the goal of Serpent's Walk, and also of the prediction by Ahmed Huber, who again, when quoted in the San Francisco Chronicle in March of 2002, said, quote, "The U.S. is the ally of 15 million Jews against 1.3 billion Muslims. It is allied with 5 million Israelis against 200 million Arabs. We'll bring down the Israel lobby and change foreign policy. We'll do it in America. When it happens, you'll understand." Unquote. Well, that is what is happening right now. And next week, we're going to take a look at sort of the media end of things. In particular, we're going to compare some of the coverage of the latest Mideast war with the two topics that I least enjoy talking about. One is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the other is the O.J. Simpson case. In both, however, and both are very important, both are worth studying not only because of the facts in and of themselves, but because the way they are being represented is a remarkable case study in how the media can break up and then reassemble information in such a way as to drive home the point that they want to drive home rather than what is actually taking place. And we're going to take a look at O.J. Agonistes and Palestinian pornography next week. But in this broadcast, we're going to take a look at the legacy, the manifest and many-sided legacy of Otto von Bolschwing. Now, to veteran listeners, that is a name that is well known. To people who are relatively new to the program, it is not so well known. Otto von Bolschwing was a key SS man and German spy in World War II. He was, for a period of time, the superior of Adolf Eichmann, who was in charge of the liquidation of European Jewry. Otto von Bolschwing was also one of the SS officers who jumped to the CIA at the end of World War II, courtesy of the Galen spy organization, about which we're going to say more in a minute. And Otto von Bolschwing also was one of the key Nazi operatives with regard to formulating Middle East policy for the Third Reich. And we're going to talk about that later in the program, because I would suggest that the geopolitical stratagem arrived at by or concocted by Otto von Bolschwing and his associate Jack Philby are in fact being put into play very successfully around the world today. And that stratagem, namely using Zionism as sort of a geopolitical agent provocateur to alienate the Muslim world and the Arab world to drive it into the arms of the Axis or the Underground Reich in the post-war period, and thereby to gain control of the Earth Island and the world's petroleum resources, well, I would submit that's exactly what's taking place. Part of the reason that is taking place is the von Bolschwing legacy and also the media strategy that has been exemplified and explicitly stated in Serpent's Walk. Now, Otto von Bolschwing, after his stint with the CIA, was one of the Nazis brought into the United States under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. I've spoken about this many times. The Crusade for Freedom is talked about in many broadcasts, including, for the record, 468. That's the Gipper in the Underground Reich. Von Bolschwing was one of the Nazis brought into the U.S. under the auspices of the Crusade for Freedom. The Crusade for Freedom was an illegal domestic intelligence operation put together by Alan Dulles, later CIA director, key Warren Commission member, fired by Kennedy for lying to Kennedy about the Bay of Pigs, and then sitting in, quote, judgment, unquote, over the investigation, or, quote, investigation of Kennedy's murder. Alan Dulles invested the Wall Street money on behalf of Hitler, including the Bush family's money. And Alan Dulles basically came up with the idea of counteracting, quote, Jewish, unquote, electoral influence in the Democratic Party and maximizing anti-communist sentiment among some of the Central and Eastern European ethnic voting blocs in the United States. Dulles felt this could be done by bringing Nazis into the U.S. to put into our political milieu. And under that program, the Crusade for Freedom, a misnomer if ever there was one, not only Central and Eastern European Nazi collaborators, but entire SS intelligence units and war criminals of the First Order were not only brought into the United States, but placed in a position of primacy in the Republican Party's ethnic outreach arm. The guy who oversaw this program for Alan Dulles was a young California congressman named Richard Nixon. Of course, later Nixon became president of the United States. The key spokesperson for this program was a young B-grade movie actor named Ronald Reagan. He later, of course, became governor of California and president of the United States. As mentioned above, it was William Casey who became the top dog with Cap Cities, which bought out ABC prior to its merger with Disney. And William Casey was the fellow who oversaw the State Department machinations to bring these guys into the United States in the first place. And the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, the repository for the Crusade for Freedom Nazis, was installed as a permanent element of the Republican Party when George H.W. Bush was chairman of the Republican National Committee. That's the father, of course, of the current, or for the time being current, for another 2 days, current president of the United States. Otto von Bolschwing had as one of his proteges a woman named Helena von Dahm. Von Dahm selected all of the personnel from which Ronald Reagan made his gubernatorial selections when he was governor of California. She then jumped to Washington, and she did the same thing for Reagan's presidential campaigns, namely selecting the lists of personnel from which Ronald Reagan made his cabinet appointments. And basically, with the ascension of Helena von Dahm and Ronald Reagan, the personnel selection outlook, so to speak, of Otto von Bolschwing and the Third Reich became the dominant, the prevailing dynamic in the selection of Republican Party personnel. And it is the von Bolschwing, von Dahm, Crusade for Freedom, Underground Reich personnel milieu that has been running this country, running it into the ground, too, I would say, for the last several decades, and the ruin that they have engendered is what is encompassing and overwhelming all of us, yea, verily, as we speak. As I'm speaking in January of 2009, the current issue of Vanity Fair magazine has an article about the Bush administration, an oral history of what went wrong, and it said, how could so many things have gone wrong? I'll start side two by reading that quote, just as I began side one by reading the Ahmed Huber quote. It wasn't an accident, it was deliberate, and what you're witnessing is the destruction of the United States and the realization of the von Bolschfing legacy. So we're going to be taking a look in this broadcast at the legacy of Otto von Bolschfing, both in the United States and in the Middle East. The legacy of Otto von Bolschfing is that the United States could be compared with a hijacked airplane. And although some of the policies are in agreement with some of the policies of the cartel luminaries within the GOP and other moneyed circles, so to speak, the fact of the matter is that what we're witnessing is the death of America, and I think even beyond the coming of fascism to what's going to be left of it, the end of the Enlightenment itself. But we're going to be looking at the von Bolschfing legacy both in the United States and outside of the United States as well. And we're going to, by way of review for some people and by way of introduction for newer listeners, we're going to review a little bit of an article that was published in Covert Action Quarterly in 1990. It was authored by Carl Oglesby, the author of The Yankee and Cowboy War, and originally it was from Covert Action Information Bulletin, the fall of 1990. It's called The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt, and it reads in part as follows. William Shirer closed his 1960 masterpiece, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, with the judgment that the Nazi regime had passed into history, unquote. But we cannot be so confident today. On the contrary, the evidence as of 1990 is that World War II did not end as Shirer believed it did, that Nazism did not surrender unconditionally and disappear, that indeed it finessed a limited but crucial victory over the Allies, a victory no less significant for having been kept a secret from all but the few Americans who were directly involved. Oglesby's article goes on to discuss some of the Nazi contingency plans for defeat. And one of the contingency plans was the stratagem of Heinrich Himmler. And Oglesby writes, within the German general staff, two competing groups formed around the question of what to do. One led by Heinrich Himmler, the other by Martin Bormann. And then he goes on to describe Himmler's plan was to continue to fight and to wait for the alliance between the ultra-capitalists of the U.S. and the ultra-Marxists of the Soviet Union to disintegrate. But then Oglesby goes on to say, but Martin Bormann, who was even more powerful than Himmler, did not accept the premise of the separate peace idea. Bormann was an intimate of Hitler's, the deputy Führer, and the head of the Nazi Party, and thus superior to Himmler in rank. Bormann wielded additional power as Hitler's link to the industrial and financial cartels that ran the Nazi economy, and parenthetically, the global economy as well, and was particularly close to Hermann Schmitz, chief executive of IG Farben, the giant chemical firm that was Nazi Germany's greatest industrial power. With the support of Schmitz, Bormann rejected Himmler's separate peace strategy on the ground that it was far too optimistic. The Allied military advantage was too great, Bormann believed, for Roosevelt to be talked into a separate peace. Roosevelt, after all, had taken the lead in proclaiming the Allies' demand for Germany's unconditional surrender and total denazification. Bormann reasoned rather that the Nazis' best hope of surviving military defeat lay within their own resources, chief of which was the cohesion of tens of thousands of SS men for whom the prospect of surrender could offer only the gallows. Bormann and Schmitz developed a more aggressive, self-contained approach to the problem of the looming military defeat, the central concept of which was that large numbers of Nazis would have to leave Europe and at least for a time find places in the world in which to recover their strength. This is exactly, by the way, what's talked about in Serpent's Walk. There were several possibilities in Latin America, most notably Argentina and Paraguay, South Africa, Egypt, and Indonesia were also attractive rear areas in which to retreat. After the German defeat in the Battle of Normandy in June of 1944, Bormann took the first external steps toward implementing concrete plans for the Nazis' great escape. An enormous amount of Nazi treasure had to be moved out of Europe and made safe. This treasure was apparently divided into several caches, of which one at the Reichsbank in Berlin included almost 3 tons of gold, much of it the so-called tooth gold from the slaughter camps, as well as silver, platinum, tens of thousands of carats of precious stones, and perhaps $1 billion in various currencies. By the way, this is 1940s figures, folks. It's exponentially greater now. There were industrial assets to be expatriated, including large tonnages of specialty steel and certain industrial machinery, as well as blueprints critical to the domination of certain areas of manufacturing. Key Nazi companies needed to be relicensed outside Germany in order to escape the reach of war reparations claims. And tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals, almost all of them members of the SS, needed help to escape Germany and safely regroup in foreign colonies capable of providing security and livelihoods. For help with the first three of these tasks, Bormann convened a secret meeting of key German industrialists on August 10, 1944, at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg. And it goes on to describe some of the minutes of those meetings. By the way, you can read about this in its entirety in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which is available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. And you can also read some key excerpts of the Martin Bormann text, sort of a distillation of it, in the description for For the Record 305. And then the minutes excerpted here read, "The Nazi Party is ready to supply large amounts of money to those industrialists who contribute to the post-war organization abroad. In return, the party demands all financial reserves which have already been transferred abroad or may later be transferred so that after the defeat, a strong new Reich may be built." And this is the plan for surviving defeat as devised by Martin Bormann, and as realized, and this is discussed at great length in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning. But in the context of the von Bolschwing legacy, it's important to understand General Reinhard Gehlen. We've spoken about him at length in the past. He's featured in many archive shows and For the Record programs. The Gehlen organization was a key element of the Odessa, the post-World War II SS underground, and in some cases, overground. Skipping down in Oglesby's essay here, "The international organization created to accommodate Bormann's plans is most often called the Odessa, a German acronym for Organizations of Veterans of the SS." Skipping down. "The final element of the Odessa was the so-called Gehlen organization, the Nazi intelligence system that sold itself to the U.S. at the end of the war. It was by far the most audacious, most critical, and most essential part of the entire Odessa undertaking. The literature on the Odessa and that on the Gehlen organization, however, are two different things. No writer in the field of Nazi studies has yet explicitly associated the two, despite the fact that General Reinhard Gehlen was tied politically as well as personally with both Otto Skorzeny and Hjalmar Schacht. Moreover, Gehlen's fabled post-war organization was in large part staffed by SS Nazis who are positively identified with the Odessa, men such as the infamous Franz Alfred Six and Emil Augsburg of the Wannsee Institute. An even more compelling reason for associating Gehlen with the Odessa is that, without his organization as a screen, the various Odessa projects would have been directly exposed to American intelligence. If the Counterintelligence Corps and the Office of Strategic Services had not been neutralized by the Gehlen ploy, the Odessa's great escape scheme would have been discovered and broken into. It is the Gehlen organization as not only one of the key elements of the Odessa plan, but as a direct underground extension of the Third Reich that we're going to be focusing on here for our understanding of the von Bolschwing legacy. This, however, concludes side one of For the Record program number 660, Walking the Snake in the Middle East, part one, The von Bolschwing Legacy. This has been recorded on January 18th of the year 2009. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.